People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're tuned to Fine Music Radio, and it's time for People of Note. Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you. And let me tell you about my guest this week. He's the author Brent Meersman, a well-known journalist whose work is published internationally. He's currently co-editor of Ground Up. He's the chairperson of the Cape Town Press Club, and he's a compulsive traveler who apparently has visited the Antarctic as well as 85 countries at last count. His latest book, his latest of eight books, is called Rattling the Cage, and the one just before that, A Childhood Made Up, Living with My Mother's Madness. And this was the reason I actually invited Brent in to talk about this very, very personal book, which Zapiro has described as cathartic, insightful, funny, and most of all, courageous. So Brent Meersman, welcome to the People of Note studio.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. The one question that I've wanted to ask you about this book, A Childhood Made Up, was why did you write it? Because it is incredibly personal. And although people have said it's humorous, there's also pain in it, and it's a very open expose of you and your life and your family. Did you feel you needed to write it? Did you think people want to read it?
Well, I think that, you know, as a writer, we actually have a job to do in society. And one of our main contributions of what we do is that we will try and articulate emotions and feelings, which everybody feels and has experienced in their lives, but don't necessarily know exactly how to articulate that experience, or would not want to make those feelings that they've had privately public. So I think we do that for other people. I think that's, you know, that's what we do as writers. So I'm articulating and expressing deeply personal emotions, which are not unique to me, but I think that is also, that's helpful, and that's a contribution that we make. The other reason, of course, was that I think that, as the book details, you know, it's got that subtitle, Living with My Mother's Madness, and yes. I wanted a subtitle everybody could relate to.
Yeah.
But in my true. Case, maybe a little bit more so, yeah. Since my mother was diagnosed as having schizophrenia. And I just think that the knowledge, the lack of knowledge, the ignorance, the fear around mental conditions is of such a nature that I really felt that I wanted to write something and make a contribution to that as well, because it's so little understood. And also, although there's lots written about bipolar, many people with bipolar have written, I looked around for years and I found that there was extremely little about the children of people who've been diagnosed with schizophrenia. So that was, those are the main reasons.
And what is interesting, Brent, is that right at the back, you write a chapter on what schizophrenia is from a layperson's point of view, which is very easy to understand. So after reading the book, you know, that was a great help, which I think people will find a great help. Why did you decide to do that for that very reason?
Yes, I did. And also I wanted to make it quite clear, if it wasn't clear enough in the way that the memoir goes, of more acceptance, and also of the fact that when my mother was diagnosed and the way she was treated was very, very different from the way things happen now. So, for instance, Falkenberg was not the caring, loving, wonderful, generous, extraordinary institution which it is today. At that stage in the 1950s, I mean, it was more like, well, my mom described it as a prison camp.
Yes.
And, of course, she had shock therapy for 4 years there. So I also wanted to make clear that there's much more hope, and that the condition is better understood and better treated these days.
It's an interesting read because, as I said, when I saw it, I thought, now, why do I want to hear about Brent's childhood, knowing that you've written these other books, which we'll talk about as well? But it's an interesting read in that it's not mawkish. It's not sort of self-pitying. And so it makes sense when you say you wanted to share something with people who might not be able to articulate these things. And I think anyone who has lived with a mother with any sort of problems will be able to relate to this. What sort of response have you had from it?
Quite incredible. And nowadays with social media, you know, because I'm quite easy to find on things like Twitter and Facebook and, mm-hmm. you know, these platforms. I had a great reaction from people who wrote to me on Facebook, total strangers, and telling me how important the book had been for them. And that was really rewarding. I mean, if I had to listen to myself, I'm so critical. I would never write another book, but it's the readers that actually keep one going as a writer.
Yeah. And there were four of you, weren't there? It was your mother, father, your brother, and yourself, four of you living
That's
in a flat
correct.
In Milnerton,
yes.
where most of this took place.
Yes.
And your father was also tricky. Mm.
Yeah, now that was a whole other thing. So he lived through the Nazi occupation of Belgium. I think it permanently scarred him. He also had a speech impediment, which made it very difficult for him to relate. He came as an immigrant to South Africa. He was abused as a child, but he broke that cycle. It's extraordinary for me how we were never hit as children. We were treated mm-hmm. in the way that children are only treated nowadays, thanks to the new laws around corporal punishment.
Right.
And then, of course, he sank into kind of alcoholism and depression. So, yeah, so there was that to deal with as well. But an isolated individual, and in a way, the two conditions of both parents seem to have complemented each other.
Well, they've clearly left you as a successful writer, Brent. But also music, and you've chosen some very interesting tracks, I see. The first, A Nocturne by Chopin. Mm. Is there a story here?
Well, possibly his best-known work, but he composed it when he was only 20. But it was one of my mother's absolutely favorite pieces of music, so I'd like to share that with the public. And we also played it at the memorial when she died.
Thank you.
the music of Chopin, his Nocturne No. 2 in E flat, Opus 9, played by Edel Biret. And the first choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, the author Brent Meersman, whose most recent book is called Rattling the Cage, but I got all absorbed in the one he wrote just before that called A Childhood Made Up, Living with My Mother's Madness. And it turned out to be an extraordinary read in many, many ways. And we were talking about your father, Brent, and you said during the break for music that he was a particularly interesting man, and that he never, your brother, for example, apparently really got to hate him, didn't he? But you didn't.
No, the tensions rose in the house, and I think it was very difficult. And I say that my brother really made the sane decision. The sane decision was to get the hell out of there and as far away as possible.
And that's what he did, didn't he? He went to Cuba.
No, he went to Europe.
Did he go to Europe?
Yeah, he went to Europe. And then he moved to the UK. But he got as far away as possible while I stayed.
Was he older than you?
Yes, he was a few years older than me, and I think that there was much more of a confrontation with the father figure.
Yes.
Also, you know, looking after my mother at the same time. So then basically he broke off all contact, and we had no contact whatsoever, and it was enormously painful and incredibly difficult for me. But there's another chapter which I can add now, and
yes.
For the first time, I think, and that is that since the book came out, he found a copy of it and he read it. And I haven't seen him since 1994. And I got an email and he's reconnected and he said just how much the book meant to him and how much it moved him. So we have actually reconnected and been communicating since then.
What a wonderful thing to have happened, yes. Because you weren't fighting, you and your brother. It's just that he chose to get the hell out of there, as it were.
Yes, and I think that he's, and I think he went into mourning in a way. And you can imagine, he was also leaving because of the army. He was fleeing, fleeing military conscription. And then he landed up as this, this deracinated individual in Belgium, struggling with the language, having gone through that when he was a child, because we went, the whole family moved to Belgium in the early 1970s, and then we returned to South Africa because of my mother's condition. She had lapsed back into psychosis, and it was better to bring the family home. So he was going to relive that experience in a way, and he went as a refugee, essentially, that even though the whole of Europe was against apartheid, if you defected from the apartheid military, you were considered to be a runaway. So there were all those contradictions. So he had to deal with that, and all these little factors have played roles in my life. And I was thinking just the other day that, you know, why am I so concerned about the condition of immigrants in South Africa and of xenophobia and all these things? And I think it comes out of part of these experiences of my dad having come as an immigrant and then of my brother having fled as a refugee. So at Ground Up, we write a lot about immigrants.
We're going to talk about Ground Up soon.
Sure.
But, I mean, there's this, the Belgian episode, isn't there, which sounded actually as though it was the hardest for your father, because he really battled, didn't he, to keep the family. He thought he was taking you to a new life, and it didn't work out that way, did it?
No, he thought that everything would be better back in Belgium, and he had all this nostalgic vision of his country, only to be confronted with his terrible father. Mm-hmm. Now, my grandfather was a hero of the resistance, I've still got some of his medals that he received. He was also a champion boxer, and he had been in the cavalry in the First World War, and a very hard man, but this great hero. Meanwhile, he would go home and he would be violent towards his child, which has always left me skeptical of struggle heroes. I want to know what do they do at home.
That's an interesting point.
I'm not always taken in by by the great heroes of this world. And that taught me many, many lessons as well. So my grandfather's story is also a fascinating story. And my father's survival of that, I think, is also remarkable.
Yeah. And you came back to South Africa, and, I mean, you also had financial problems, didn't you, as a result of that move and then coming back and your father having to work long hours. with a wife that was becoming unstable?
Yes, because, and also my mother never worked. She never had a professional job. That was not something that she felt that she could do. She had worked as a secretary. She'd been quite successful in that, but then she had her series of breakdowns and she had went into Falkenberg. But yes, we were very poor for white people in South Africa, and we really struggled just to put food on the table. And it's interesting in the circles where I've moved and, you know, how my own life has changed, where so often I'm in environments where, you know, not a single person around me has actually had a father who put on an overall every day and was covered in oil and worked on a factory floor at a machine. And so that, I think, has also given me an enormous more insight into, let's say, the working class and a much closer identification with those kind of struggles in South African history as well.
We must talk about your mother's painting and horse riding, but let's have your next piece of music from Jewish folk poetry. There's a Jewish connection here with your mother in a sense, isn't there?
Yes, she believed she was Jewish towards the end of her life.
But she wasn't Jewish.
Not that we know of. And my grandmother was Ruby Morris, but I don't the English. There's no evidence that we were Jewish. She had this belief later on in life. And this is a cycle of songs that Shostakovich wrote, which you couldn't perform because of Stalin.
Yes,
only performed it in 1955, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's an exquisitely beautiful piece, and I thought it was appropriate here because of its beauty and also because it's the connection between the mother and the son.
Oh,
That was the first song from a cycle by Shostakovich called From Jewish Folk Poetry, Lament, and it was sung by Elizabeth Söderström. And it was the choice of my guest, Brent Meersman, on People of Note this week. Brent's just written a book called A Childhood Made Up, Living with My Mother's Madness, which we've been talking about. But there's also Rattling the Cage, your latest book, Brent, which we're coming to. But I mentioned just before the music, one of the things that really seemed to keep your mother going was her painting. She seemed, certainly up to a point in her life, to be absolutely absorbed by painting. Mm. It was her world, wasn't it?
Yes, it was her world. It was her therapy. It was her way of existing. Mm. I think that she was an artist in the very truest sense of that word. She would describe herself just as a housekeeper and a housewife. And from the outside, if you met her, she's a very sweet lady, and not obvious in any way. No big career, no profession, no degree at university, but an extraordinary rich interior imagination. And she had the sharpest eye. You know, we would, on the occasion that she would go out, which was very seldom, we would go into town, and I, you know, we'd do some shopping or something and then come back on the bus. And then her scribbler the next day would be filled with drawings, and I could instantly recognize, the people that I had glimpsed and seen the previous day in town. She had caught them absolutely perfectly. Mm-hmm. But her problem was, you know, not so much the schizophrenia as the fact that she was a woman in South Africa trying to be an artist in the 1960s and 70s.
Yes.
And she had all that against her, this incredibly masculine world of male art critics and male gallery owners and the general public. And that proved a big obstacle. And then also because of the schizophrenia, she never had formal and proper training. She couldn't take that as far as she would have otherwise. Mm-hmm. And developed more if she'd been able to just dedicate herself to have more influences and more people helping, I think things would have been different.
Did she ever have an exhibition?
Yes, she won a few competitions where her paintings were in, you know, but just community competitions at the libraries and things. She'd won a few of those. When we moved over to Belgium, a gallery took an interest in her work and she sold a number of pieces there. But she never ever mounted an exhibition. I mean, we were just struggling, you know, forget about even framing the pictures. We didn't have money for that. The pictures would stand on little, my dad would put two nails and a little plank in the wall. I mean, literally all over the house, and the paintings would stand on these little pelmets because we couldn't afford frames. You know,
where are they now, these paintings?
So there were a lot of paintings. And then the exhibition I gave her an exhibition posthumously, and was one of the things I wanted to do for her. So a couple of years after she died, we put together an exhibition, and a very nice one with about 70 works of art, and almost all of them sold. People loved them, and I was sorry to part with any of them.
Yes, but it must have been.
But of course, I'm much happier that somebody cherished it and thought it was important enough that they would buy it.
Yeah.
And every now and then I wander into a place or a friend's home and I suddenly see, oh, there's one of Mom's paintings on the wall.
That must be a good feeling.
So they live on. Yeah. Other than that, I probably have a couple of hundred.
Oh, still?
Yes. And in my flat in Tambuurskloof, I have the whole one room is wall to wall with them. They're plastered all right around the walls, touching each other almost like tiles.
Yes.
But those were the works that you could do that with, of course, various friezes of figures and things.
There's a lovely, well, I suppose you could call it anecdotal, where she apparently became quite skilled at drawing male nudes. And she was terrified in those days of people seeing pornography being strictly banned and all that. Wasn't she? Yes. She didn't like people to see these paintings.
Yes, because she thought they'd be frowned upon in conservative, rather backward South Africa. They didn't understand art. And in fact, people would, you know, people who did make it past the front door would kind of giggle and snigger and, you know, find this all terribly. And there's a story that she loved to tell me about some neighbors, I think they were called the Bassons, and he told her the story, and he was so proud of his son because this family had managed to go on holiday to Europe, and they had been in Florence, and they had seen the statue of David, and his little boy said, "Oh, Sispa." And he thought this was hilarious, which I suppose it is, rather tragic. And you must remember at that time, even SABC in an art program, I mean, they would censor, you know, they would, Kenneth Clark's Civilization, they might cut out a nude genital.
Absolutely.
Even if it was made out of stone.
Bizarre. And your mother, she came from Freiburg,
yes,
and developed a love of horses there as well, and
yes,
that stayed with her for her life, didn't
yes,
she?
Yes, they had a big cattle ranch, so she was a wrangler. She'd go out and she'd herd the cattle.
What do you think your mother would have thought had she been alive and you wrote this book? Do you think she would have been proud of you?
Or
do you think she would have been offended?
I think she was proud of anything that I did. I don't know. She probably wouldn't have liked it very much. And I would never have published something like this while she was alive. Not that there's any bad reflections on her. I think that it's just, you know, there's a lot to be said for privacy. And she was a very private individual.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think that, you know, waiting for your parents to die is a common thing with writers before you can write that one book that might be your best.
Right, okay. Brent, we're going to take another break now, then move on to some of your other activities, because there's so much to talk about. And we've got Schnittke here, a piano quintet. Now tell me how this comes into the picture.
Well, you know, I've been fascinated by Schnittke, and he's not to everybody's taste. And I've chosen a piece which I think is more listenable than many general listeners would find. It's a waltz, but with his unique qualities. Interestingly enough, Schnittke dedicated this work to his mother, this particular quintet. So it appeals to me, and it also appeals to me, you know, dramatic music appeals to me. But this is the drama of the interior. It's very inward focused. It's the inward psychological drama that I find riveting, and I wanted to share.
There's music by Alfred Schnittker, the 20th century composer, from his piano quintet, The Waltz, played by the Borodin String Quartet. And it was the choice, another choice, of my guest on People of Note this week on Fine Music Radio, the author Brent Meersman. Brent, we've talked a lot about your book, A Childhood Made Up, in that it's so personal. But in the course of reading this book, I realized that you started writing quite early. You were writing novels when you were two bricks and a ticky high.
Indeed.
Where did that come from?
I mean, literally sitting on a box so that I could get my little fingers above my mom's Olivetti typewriter.
Yes.
And I could hammer away.
Right.
Yes, I always wanted to be a writer. It came into my head. I don't know exactly why. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was an influence from my mom. I know she had tried her hand at writing, and she'd actually written a novel, which she very grandly threw into off the – we were on the HMS Randfontein when we left for Belgium, and she threw it in the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh,
the only copy of her manuscript, much to my father's horror, who thought it was rather good.
Yeah.
I was plugging away writing, you know, Biggles inspired books as a child. And I always kept on writing, and then had a long hiatus where I had to concentrate basically on looking after my parents and making money and surviving. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as I was able to return to it, I did. And I've been publishing a book every second year now for the last 16, 17 years.
And mostly novels?
Yes, they've mostly been novels. They've been four novels. Mm-hmm. And then there's been a travel book, rather a naughty diary, around the world. And then the book of essays, most recently. There's a book of poetry, and then the memoir. So,
okay, but this one that's just come out, Rattling the Cage, which I haven't seen, so I haven't had a chance to page through it. Just Whet Our Appetites, tell me what that's all about.
Right, so that's a collection of essays about reflecting on democratic South Africa, what's happened since 1994, and why does South Africa look the way it looks at the moment? That's the question I'm asking. And then I trace the transition politically, economically, and socially from to 1994, and then follow up with the various, you know, the issues of the day. I look at everything from, you know, immigration to social grants to the economy and its current state, and then look a little bit over the picket fence as well. So the final section of the book, the last few chapters there, are about climate change and the planet and the health of the planet.
Mm-hmm. What inspired you to write that?
Well, I've been writing about South Africa, in addition to the novels and all my other stuff, I've been writing about South Africa for more than 20 years as a journalist.
Mm.
And I was a columnist for a long time with the Mail and Guardian and This Is Africa and New Africa Analysis in London. And now, of course, with Ground Up, I'm sort of feel very much like I'm in the frontline trenches there with hard news stories that we are doing. I had thoughts, and I didn't think that I thought I could bring a unique perspective, and I think I have done that. And having read so much other nonfiction, which I was a voracious reader, I found that there was something still to be said about these issues and to be articulated. Mm-hmm. That's the collection of essays.
Tell me a little bit about Ground Up.
Yes. Ground Up is a news agency, so you are probably reading our stuff, a lot of it, without necessarily knowing so, because people don't generally pay much attention to the little bylines and you know, the fact that this story is from Ground Up. But if you're reading any of the major news networks like Times Live or News 24 and Daily Maverick and many, many others, sorry to leave out our other republishers. But
I can list endlessly.
But you're probably reading our stories all the time. So, and we focus on human rights and social issues. Those are our primary focuses.
Now, we're recording this interview as the Great Fire is hopefully coming to an end. Mm. And you were very excited when you were telling me how your team has actually succeeded in getting itself into an American network.
Yes, I was very pleased to see that Nature, the international periodical, has actually used one of our photographs as their lead on the story, which is about what's been lost in terms of the science libraries in the fire at UCT. But yes, our reporters have been out and they've been on the ground, and we've been, there's always it's sad and terrible events, and certainly the student protests were another case the first cycle of student protests with the Roads Must Fall, which kept us incredibly busy. So there's always this double thing for the news, for the news hound, you know. There's this thrill and this excitement and of this news story, and then also you just see the readership explode around these stories because everybody's interested and it flies around the world, and that's a big thrill. But at the same time, you're deeply aware of just you really would rather not have to write these stories at all.
Right. But Brent, you've got reporters working for you. It's a whole organization.
Yes, it's a whole organization. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And how are you funded?
We do a lot of freelancers. It's the best news job in the world, I say, because we are fully foundation funded. And the foundations never impinge on our editorial lines or on anything. So we don't have to worry about eyeball counts. We don't have to worry about writing clickbait headlines. We don't have to worry about advertisers that want certain placement, or corporate advertisers who suddenly find themselves as the subject of the news story and one has to tread around. We don't have megalomaniac, egomaniac owners of our media corporation, which is not unknown phenomena, and we don't have that kind of intrusion from the owners. So it really we can do good old fashioned hard journalism, which, by the way, is fact checked.
Now, how do you read Groundup? Is it online?
We're online with our own website, so groundup.org.za, okay. And you can find all our news there, and then, as I say, you're reading us all the time.
Yes, I'm going to have to look out more carefully in the little corners. I see we've got Messiaen coming up, that remarkable work he did, the quartet for the end of time. Now, why have you put this in?
Well, first of all, it's an extraordinary piece of music, but it's about survival. And, I'm thinking of my father and having lived through the Nazi occupation. Now, Messiaen, of course, composed this particular piece while he was a prisoner of war.
That's right.
And while he was in the camp. And the interesting thing about it is, of course, he had to compose it for the instruments that were available, and even more so, taking into account the condition that those instruments were in. So for me, it's an extraordinary piece of music, and it's about survival in distress. And so it speaks to me very much about my father.
And this movement, Praise for the Immortality of Jesus.
Yes, again, it's got that sense of transcendence, even though you're in predicament.
Thank you. That's a movement from that extraordinary work by Messiaen called The Quartet for the End of Time. And the players there, Sashko Gavrilov, Hans Deinzer, Siegfried Palm, and Alois Kontarski. A taste of Messiaen here on People of Note. Brent Meersman is my guest. In the little time we've got left, Brent, one of the things that's always fascinated me about you is your absolute passion for travel. Mm. I mean, it says 85 countries, I said earlier. Mm. Why? Travel broadens the mind, they say.
Very much so. And I think that, you know, when you travel, it's like, you know, we all drive on the left-hand side of the road. And then you go to another country and you find out that people can drive on the right-hand side. And it's different, but it works perfectly well.
Yes, yes.
And that, for me, is what traveling really is about. So I've, and also I think it was instilled, that love of adventure and getting around was instilled by my extraordinary aunt, who was like a character out of
was she the one that was at the United Nations?
Yes, she was at the United Nations and based all over the world and caught in various wars and revolutions from the Sikhs in India to the Gaza Strip and revolutions in Guatemala. And she would always come back with these wonderful tales. So she put the love of travel into me. And I've been traveling. I try and do 2 or 3 trips a year. Now I'm not quite sure. Obviously, things have changed. And also, I think that maybe one day in the future, people look back and when you say that you went to 85 countries and all the continents, people will gasp and say, your carbon footprint? What a you are a criminal! You know,
that's true. What a
dreadful thing you've been doing. So it might be something not to be proud of in the future.
But for me,
it was meeting people, yes.
How did you go? Were you sponsored to do stories, or did you just decide, I want to go to Guatemala?
I could be living in a very big house by now if I hadn't traveled such a lot. No, not sponsored, but I travel in different ways. But very often I just take my little backpack and I get on a plane and I don't always know where I'm going to stay the following night. And then I will get to this country and I'll make it up as I go along.
Gosh, we're so different.
And I'll just go from one to the next.
Yeah.
And I try to go, you know, somewhere which is, you know, said to be civilized. I mean, like, I try to get a lot to Europe and North America. But then I go to very out of the way places. And
like Antarctica, which must have been an experience.
Right. And then also I just traveled through Burma and Laos and Cambodia recently.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to go off the beaten track and into the jungles and up on the mountains and into all different climes. And I will sleep in tents and I will sleep in hostels. I don't feel I'm too old for that. So I'm quite proud when I manage to sleep in a hostel.
I need a 5-star hotel, Brent.
I do, but only once a week.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I will clean up.
Exactly. I will pace it in that way.
Okay.
And just take public transport. But these days, really, with apps and with all the other things, it is so simple. I mean, if you've got Google Translate on your phone and you've got Google Maps, and you can book any hostel and you can say, I want it, you know, with air conditioning or a fan and hot water or cold water and under 80 Rand a night, you will find it. It will be on an app and there'll be like 100 and something choices in this town.
The other thing I caught sight of in your book and made me fill with nostalgia was you were on the RMS St. Helena, the glorious RMS St. Helena.
Yes.
But you were coming from Ascension, so you obviously stopped at St. Helena and then you had to get off in Walvis Bay or something.
Yes, that's right. So that trip was a very interesting one. So you could, at that point, you could take an RAF Boeing on its way to the Falklands, but it would land in Ascension Island.
Mm.
So you leave from Brize Norton in the UK, fly to Ascension Island, and then pick up the RMS St. Helena, go to St. Helena after a few days on Ascension, and then normally it would go Walvis Bay and then come down to Cape Town, but I had to jump ship in Walvis Bay because my father had suffered a terrible stroke, I jumped, and the ship would take several days, so I flew back.
You need time on the ships.
Oh,
and wasn't
wonderful.
She a beautiful ship, the RMS
and still going. I believe it's been refitted even though they were going to, and for the money that they've wasted on that airport that sort of didn't work initially. I think they could probably have a fleet of ships going backwards and forwards.
Exactly. Brent, we have to end now, but thank you for a very interesting conversation. We'll keep a lookout for your book called Rattling the Cage. And the book I've been talking about in some detail is called A Childhood Made Up, Living with My Mother's Madness. And this is published by Tafelberg. Mm-hmm. And Thanks for sharing with us, Brent. And your music as well, which has been, I have to say, different. Like this last piece, Alvo Peart, Cantus in Memory of Benjamin Britten. Why does this make an appearance, apart from the fact that it's a fairly hypnotic work?
Yes, well, I'm fascinated by Peart, which he divides the classical community. Some people think he's overrated. I find his music wonderful, and actually the first time I heard about him was the fact that he had gone apparently on a silent retreat and he hadn't spoken for 2 years or something while he got himself into his music. But this one is here. This one is really for my father, and I played it after he died. It's the one piece of music that really speaks to me about the eternity of time, and that the relentless, unstoppable persistence of time, which was very significant for me at that on my father's passing. And I do hope that you'll be able to play it through to the very end.
Yes, it's a bit on the line. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll join it slightly after the opening, so that we get that magical, mysterious ending.
Thank you.
Brent Meersman was my guest. Brent, thank you very much. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.